everybody. This is Jim Breeling. Welcome to our Sunday evening call-in session for the night. If you're on the East Coast, I hope you're all ready for the Frankenstorm. From some of the early forecasts, I feared that we might be without power and kind of wiped out tonight, but at least here in Washington, it's coming in slowly with now drizzle, but the wind is picking up, and I guess we're going to get the full dose Monday and Tuesday. But tonight we're going to get a full dose of some very interesting and important research findings from one of the leaders in the field, Mary Zanarini, who's been extremely productive, very involved in the collaborative longitudinal study of personality disorders with four sites that has replicated the essence of her findings from her own prior earlier beginning longitudinal study out of McLean Hospital that we'll hear about tonight. And it has had really offered tremendous hope, but also significant challenges that we need to go face. And I want to mention, people have sent in email comments on the recent sessions, and one of the things that came through was the hope that the material being presented was giving them for progress, particularly the psychiatric management of borderline personality disorder, that there was hope where before there had only been despair, and that's really part of the transformation in the field in the last 10 years, that there is hope. And Dr. Zanarini has contributed importantly to that hope, not only through the longitudinal study, but through innovative work in other areas, testing fish oil, omega-3, for borderline, and having some interesting and encouraging results. And in other areas, with drug studies, evaluations, and also currently with a NIMH grant to test a psychoeducational curriculum for borderlines as a cost-efficient way to improve functioning. So if you have found these sessions helpful in this way, I want to remind you that while there's and others volunteer time, there are real to the recording. The session is available 24/7 through the website and the maintenance of the website. And I want to thank all those who have contributed. We've had a number of people that have given very generously to the support. We're doing better than public radio in terms of the percentage of participants, but we do still have a way to go to get up to supporting the monthly operating costs that have to be met to provide all the services that you get through the NEA PhD, NEA BPD. And I just wanted to mention that in terms of the rest of the fall session, next week we will hear from Ed Selby, who has joined Rutgers University in the psychology department. And he's one of two new junior investigators that has received funding through NARSED, with funds raised by families for borderline personality research to help him launch a productive career. And you will get to hear about his very interesting and encouraging theoretical approach that looks for a therapeutic focus for intervention across multiple disorders and problems. And then on Thanksgiving week, on Memorial Day weekend, we will not have a call because of the holiday, but on the 18th of November, we will hear about adolescent borderline personality and work with them, which is getting more and more. Thanksgiving will be a holiday, and then on December 2nd, we will have a Connecting the Dots session, very much appreciated by listeners to that based on their comments. And they will be reporting on hot things that arose at the annual conference of the Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Therapies, saving you the trouble of going there and the expense and bringing you up to date. On December 9th, we will then hear about the genetics of borderline And we will conclude on the 16th with John Oldham, who will update us on the, how would you call it, the sways and changes in direction and flip-flops and evolutions and contortions and developing the DSM-5 criteria for the personality disorders, including borderline. So it is a reminder, by the way, we appreciate your, again, your feedback and comments, and do send them. And if you have suggestions or things that we could do better or things that are bad and we could do without, please do let us know at neapbpdaol.com. And for Dr. Zanarini's presentation tonight, do send in questions. We will have some time at the end for a question and answer session, but do not try to make them general questions rather than specific to yourself or to a family member. This is an educational program, and we really can't get into the details of a specific clinical case. So with that, let me stop and get out of the way so you can really get the substance of the evening from Dr. Zanarini.
Hello and good evening. Tonight I'm going to be talking about the 10-year course of borderline personality disorder, and I hope you have handouts in front of you because I'm going to be going through the handout myself.
Mary, I don't know if people can hear you. I know I can't.
Okay. Do you want me to start over?
Yes, that's better. Good. Please.
Okay. Tonight I'm going to be talking about the 10-year course of borderline personality disorder. Borderline personality disorder, which is commonly called, as you know, BPD, is now seen as a valid disorder, according to the criteria of Robbins and Guzet from 1970. And by that I mean it can be delimited or determined from other psychiatric disorders. Something of its etiology, both environmental and biological, is known. It does run in families, and it has a complex but increasingly known course.
Okay, hold on. Now I can't seem to hear. See what you can say. I'm missing the beginning because I'm open for a part.
Okay, who is that? Do you want me to start over again? Borderline personality disorder is now recognized as a common disorder, not just a valid disorder. About 2% of American adults meet criteria for BPD. It's about as common as bipolar 1 disorder and more common than schizophrenia, so it's now viewed as valid and common. There's a continuum of borderline psychopathology. Some people with BPD recover spontaneously and are never patients. These are particularly mild cases. Some use non-intensive outpatient treatment and are never hospitalized. These are moderate cases. And others become severely ill and use large amounts of mental health services, including repeated inpatient stays. This latter group of severely ill patients has defined BPD for generations of clinicians who typically train at inpatient facilities or teaching hospitals. Until very recently, most research studies have focused on this group of patients as well. And in fact, this presentation deals with this type of severely ill patient. Tonight I'm going to be talking about results primarily from the MacLean Study of Adult Development, or MSAD, which was the first NIMH-funded prospective study of the longitudinal course of BPD. At baseline, which was 20 years ago, we assessed 362 MacLean inpatients who were consecutive inpatients to our units where people with BPD would be found. 8 waves of blind follow-up are now complete, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, and 16-year data, although tonight's talk will focus on the 10-year course. Our 18-year wave began in July of 2010, and our 20-year wave began in July of this year. Now, who were our patients? We had two groups, 290 patients meeting DIBAR and DSM-3R criteria for BPD, and I'll let you know what the DIBAR means, and 72 Access to comparison subjects meeting DSM-3R criteria for another personality disorder, but neither study criteria set for BPD. before I get to the DIB-R, DSM-3R was simply the criteria set of the American Psychiatric Association before DSM-4. And we met that criteria set because the study is 20 years old. Now, the DIB-R is a semi-structured interview that's different than the DSM, where you can specialize in hundreds of different ways and meet the criteria 5 out of 9. With the DIB-R, you have to have, it has 4 sectors of psychopathology, and you must have symptoms in all 4. You must have dysphoric affect, disturbed but non-psychotic cognition, impulsive behaviors, and troubled relationships. Now, this results in a somewhat smaller and more homogeneous group of patients than the DSM criteria. One person is very much like the next. Now, there have been earlier studies of the course of borderline personality disorder. In fact, when I was a graduate student, I began this work. And I discovered there were 17 small-scale prospective studies of the short-term course of BPD. And not surprisingly, patients with BPD were found to do quite poorly in the short run. However, there are 4 large-scale follow-back studies of the long-term course of BPD. And Tom McGlashan conducted the one that's considered the best, Chestnut Lodge study from Maryland. Michael Stone conducted another from the New York State Psychiatric Institute, where he personally interviewed all the subjects or re-interviewed them. Joel Paris from the Jewish General Hospital in Montreal, which is the only socioeconomically diverse sample. And then Eric Plakin from Austin Riggs. So 3 of the studies, the one by McGlashan, the one by Stone, and one from Plakin, studied very affluent people, young people, with uniformly or almost uniformly high IQs. Again, Joel Paris studied a general sample of people that tended to skew more toward the lower end of the spectrum. And these studies found that patients with BPD do substantially better in the long run. What's interesting about all of this research is that all of it was funded by these home institutions or even the investigators themselves, which led to some of the limitations of these earlier studies. They used either chart review or clinical interviews to diagnose BPD, not semi-structured interviews as we do nowadays uniformly. There were either no comparison group or the use of less than optimal comparison subjects, such as people with schizophrenia, which is not viewed as a near-neighbor disorder at this time. It relied on small size samples with high attrition rates, probably due to the lack of funding. They collected only very basic data at baseline and follow-up, sometimes only 2 or 3 variables were assessed. Typically, they only had 1 post-baseline reassessment and non-blind post-baseline assessments because at times only the borderline patients were followed up, where people, in fact, knew who the patients were. What their diagnoses were, and variable number of years of follow-up in the same study. In fact, in Tom McGlashan's study from the Chestnut Lodge, all 4 of these studies had around a 14 to 16-year mean follow-up. His study had something in that range. But what was interesting is that the people were actually followed up anywhere from 2 to 32 years. So our MSAD subject retention has been very high. At the 10-year follow-up, 92% of surviving patients with BPD are still participating, and 85% of surviving access to comparison subjects are still participating. And due to the Internet, we're able to tell even the people who are no longer with the study, who've declined to continue, and that's a small number, we're able to tell whether they're still alive. I'm going to go on to one of the best pieces of news in this study, and we're going to talk about the good news and then the more guarded news in a few minutes. In terms of remission rates, by the time of the 10-year follow-up, 93% of borderline patients have achieved a remission of their BPD. And by remission, I mean they no longer met either criteria set for BPD that defined this sample and did not meet it for 2 years or more. It doesn't mean they had no symptoms of BPD, but they had a massive decrement or decrease in their symptomatology. And that's very good news. Before, people thought this was a chronic disorder where no one ever got well. Well, 93% had a 2-year remission or more. And in fact, 86% had a 4-year remission or more. that's a long time to go with a very lowered level of symptoms. And in fact, let's compare it to mood disorders. Mood disorders remit much more rapidly, such as major depression. We think of it in terms many times of months, not years. However, the recurrence rate is much more common. In a famous study by Marty Keller from Brown, over time, when basically 100% of the people had a recurrence of their mood disorder. So this is a slower-moving disorder, but one ultimately with a better symptomatic outcome. Time to recurrence at the slightly less than 30% of the people experienced a recurrence, which means they moved back up into the borderline range. That's a relatively low rate of recurrence, particularly when people who work in teaching hospitals only see the people who come back again and again and again, and they think it's 100% of the people who have a recurrence. This means, looked at another way, that 70% did not, which is a very high rate of people having very stable remissions. And only 15% of the people who had a four-year or longer remission actually lost that remission. So the longer you're in remission, the less likely you are to lose it, which makes sense. But that 15% is a remarkably low level. Now, completed suicide, at the time of the 10-year follow-up, only 4% of people had committed suicide. That's much lower than the 9 to 10% that was expected. Now, why is that? I think the reason that is because people are no longer in intensive exploratory psychotherapies. Even if they're in a manualized form of treatment or an empirically derived form of treatment, these treatments basically are more supportive, more in the here and now, and they're also sensitive to people's invalidating experiences or childhood or adult adversity, would be my best guess. Now, let me talk about a complex model of borderline psychopathology, which really looks at etiology. In this model, hyperbolic temperament, or a tendency to be insistent and persistent that your pain be paid attention to, is the outward face of the neurobiological dimensions that underlie borderline psychopathology. And after a kindling event of some kind, acute and temperamental symptoms develop, and a kindling event can be normative, such as going off to college, or can be traumatic, a terrible car accident, being date raped, something of that nature. And again, hyperbolic temperament is being insistent and persistent that attention be paid to one's terrible pain. Let me define acute symptoms for you. There are four factors that help define them. One, they resolve relatively quickly. They're the best markers for the disorder. They're the very dramatic symptoms of borderline personality disorder. They're often the main reason for expensive forms of psychiatric care, such as inpatient stays. And they're akin to the positive symptoms of schizophrenia. They're akin to them. They're not similar to them. What they share is that they're dramatic, and they're what gets people into the hospital. In contrast, we have temperamental symptoms, or what I've termed temperamental symptoms. They resolve relatively slowly in comparison to the acute symptoms. They're not specific to borderline personality disorder. Many people have them. They're associated with ongoing psychosocial impairment, and they're akin to the negative symptoms of schizophrenia. They're the quieter symptoms that tend to get overlooked, but they actually pull down people's psychosocial functioning more than the acute symptoms. Now, let me give you an example of these symptoms. Acute symptoms examples would be non-suicidal self-injury or self-mutilation, suicidal efforts, and quasi-psychotic thoughts, meaning very transient delusions or hallucinations. Temperamental symptoms are, for example, would be angry feelings and acts, distrust and suspiciousness, abandonment concerns. So one very dramatic, the other quiet, one goes away quite rapidly, the other remains in play for sustained periods of time. Now, I have two figures, which some of you may be able to see and some may not, but they both compare an acute symptom, in the first case, chronic anger, to a temperamental symptom, or rather a temperamental symptom, a chronic anger, to an acute symptom, self-mutilation, and simply show that over time, the self-mutilation declines far more rapidly and far more thoroughly than the chronic anger. And the exact same picture emerges with intolerance of aloneness, which is a temperamental symptom, and suicide efforts, which is an acute symptom, that you're much more likely to have almost no level of suicide efforts at the end of 10 years, where intolerance of aloneness, it's still about 30% of the people who had the symptom at baseline who still are reporting it. Now, we actually studied 24 symptoms in the DIB-R, where we studied 22 symptoms, and then the two additional DSM symptoms that we don't study in the DIB-R, serious identity disturbance and affective lability, we also studied that as well. And we found that, somewhat symmetrically, that 12 symptoms were found to be acute in nature, and 12 symptoms were found to be temperamental in nature. And let me tell you what they were. And the reason why this is important is that these are different areas that can be focused on for treatment. And it also helps people to think about it and understand BPD, because the way the DSM is organized is just a laundry list of 9 symptoms that you can put together in any possible way, but doesn't tell you much about what people are suffering from or how to organize it. In terms of acute symptoms, again, I mentioned there are 12. One is an affective symptom, affective instability. So the very lability of borderline patients is relatively acute in that it tends to go down pretty rapidly. In terms of cognitive symptoms, quasi-psychotic thought, which I mentioned before, and serious identity disturbance. And you might say, well, why would serious identity disturbance be a cognitive symptom? It is because, in this view, it's based on overvalued ideas or ideas that I'm ugly, stupid, bad. So it's based on a misperception of your own value and worth. Impulsive symptoms tend to be acute symptoms, substance abuse, promiscuity, self-harm, suicide efforts. And then in terms of interpersonal symptoms that are acute in nature, they're again, the dramatic symptoms, the symptoms that indicate a certain feistiness in the patients that can actually be helpful. Stormy relationships, devaluation, manipulation, sadism or cruelty, or wish or need to control other people, demandingness and entitlement, serious treatment regressions, countertransference problems, which means the treaters have feelings toward the patient, and special treatment relationships, relationships where things get a bit out of hand and can go from friendships to even love affairs between treaters and patients, not a good thing, obviously. Temperamental symptoms, most of the affective symptoms of BPD are temperamental. They last quite a while. And those are depression, feelings of helplessness, hopelessness, worthlessness, feelings of anger, feelings of anxiety, and feelings of loneliness and emptiness. Two cognitive symptoms are also temperamental in nature. Odd thought, for example, overvalued ideas, which we just talked about, which are about tend to organize themselves around low self-esteem. I'm evil, I'm bad, I caused all my own problems. And unusual perceptual experiences, for example, depersonalization, which means simply feeling numb or unreal. And also non-delusional paranoia, feelings of distrust and suspiciousness that are not psychotic in their severity, but are troubling for the person and also troubling for those around the person. And also general impulsivity is temperamental in nature. For example, there seems to be forms of impulsivity that do not die away quickly, eating binges, spending sprees, reckless driving, verbal outbursts, for example. And then there are interpersonal symptoms that are temperamental in nature in the sense that they go on for quite a while, and they're the quieter symptoms of BPD that can be overlooked in the shuffle of a lot of action. And their intolerance of aloneness, the person simply can't stand being alone. Abandonment, concerns, engulfment concerns, which mean that the person's afraid of being engulfed or losing their sense of self through a dominating other, and annihilation concerns that they simply, if they lose someone who's important to them, they'll cease to exist. Counterdependency, and we see this a lot in people with BPD, they really try to help other people, offer and enter the helping professions, really fight against their own feelings of dependency. And then the last temperamental symptom would be undue dependency and masochism, or letting other people use or abuse the person. Again, while a lot of these sound pejorative, they're simply adaptations that one time worked for the person and are really survival skills. Now, again, just to help you organize these thoughts, symptoms that resolve the most rapidly, the acute symptoms, are those reflecting core areas of impulsivity, and that would be self-harm and suicide efforts, or active attempts to manage interpersonal difficulties, stormy relationships, for example, devaluation, manipulation, sadism. Again, while these things sound negative, they indicate that the person is actually struggling against their illness in an active way, which over the long term is, I think, a good thing. And in terms of the most stable symptoms, we mentioned the emotional symptoms or affective symptoms, and that would be, for example, anger, loneliness, emptiness. And the quieter interpersonal symptoms reflecting abandonment and dependency issues, for example, intolerance of aloneness and counterdependency problems. So why is that important? Beyond having a good cognitive map of what is going on for borderline patients and a system for being able to organize it, we now have 5 empirically based comprehensive forms of therapy for BPD, as many of you know. Dialectical behavioral therapy is the most researched and has the strongest evidence base. It's called DBT, and it was developed by Marshall Linehan from the University of Washington in the early 1990s. We have mentalization-based treatment, or MBT, which was developed by Anthony Bateman and Peter Fonagy of London. We have transference-focused psychotherapy, or TFP, developed by Kernberg, Clarkin, and Ken Levy from New York City. We have schema-focused therapy, or SFT, which was tested by Gießen Blue and Arnst, but based on the work of Jeffrey Young. And then we have general psychiatric management, or GPM, developed by Shelley McMain and Paul Links, then of Toronto. And this treatment is being further developed by John Gunderson with the hope that it will be something that will require less training and will be more generally available than these other forms of treatment that are expensive to deliver. Now, what's interesting and why I spent time going over the acute and temperamental symptoms is that all 5 of these treatments are aimed at the acute symptoms or what they lead to, such as hospitalizations or ER visits. We need treatments aimed at the temperamental symptoms because they have such a powerful negative impact on psychosocial functioning. Now let me talk about psychosocial functioning. The 2 ways that we've defined it, broadly defined and narrowly defined, and I'll explain what that means. But 78% of patients with BPD attain by 10 years or maintain broadly defined good psychosocial functioning over the course of 10 years of prospective follow-up. And this goal is defined as at least 1 emotionally sustaining relationship with a friend or romantic partner, but not a biological relative, and both a good vocational performance, you do well at work, and a sustained vocational history, you work steadily month after month after month. So almost 80% attain this broadly defined definition of good psychosocial functioning. However, only 64% attain or maintain narrowly defined good psychosocial functioning over the course of 10 years of prospective follow-up. And this goal is defined in psychosocially in exactly the same way, or socially, this, which is 1 emotionally sustaining relationship with a friend or romantic partner, at least, and vocational is almost the same, a good vocational performance, a sustained vocational history, and this is the difference, full-time vocational engagement. And it's the full-time vocational engagement, which can be going to school or working or taking care of your family, that really is hard for these people to attain, for some of them to attain. Now, broadly defined, good psychosocial functioning is more stable than narrowly defined good psychosocial functioning, which is not a surprise, but it's still concerning. And almost all failures to attain or actual losses of narrowly defined good psychosocial functioning were found to be due to problems in the vocational and not the social realm. Even though borderline patients have stormy relationships, many of them have relationships. They may be serial relationships, but they're very affiliated people, as you know, and so they may well have relationships. But in the world of work, it's hard. It's hard not so much because they're being fired because of interpersonal difficulties or something like that. It's because of anxious avoidance, would be one reason that not doing too well vocationally. Another would be that treaters and others, family members, often encourage people to go on disability in order to get Medicare and Medicaid so treatment can continue. And that prevents people from really working very much. Now, let's talk about the psychosocial functioning of access to comparison subjects who at baseline, when they were first hospitalized, were also young, suicidal, had stormy relationships, and yet they've turned out to function much better. In fact, 93% maintained or attained broadly defined good psychosocial functioning, and 92% maintained or attained narrowly defined good psychosocial functioning. So there's almost no difference between broadly defined or narrowly defined. These people really can have relationships and work full-time in a competent and consistent manner. Now, what are the clinical implications of these findings about psychosocial functioning? It, to me, seems the rehabilitation model might be useful for those who cannot work or go to school full-time in an effective and consistent manner. And by a rehabilitation model, I mean alongside psychotherapy, there needs to be a real effort to pay attention to how these people are functioning in the world of work or school and other areas that are problematic for them, such as sleep or pain management. This, as Jim Breeling mentioned, there's another study, the Collaborative Longitudinal Personality Disorders Study, or CLIPS, and I was lucky enough to be a co-investigator on this study. Also NIMH-funded. It's now complete after 10 years. But it found basically the same symptomatic and psychosocial findings. So these are not unique to my study. This other major study, which had some real differences in terms of how it was organized and arranged, came up with exactly the same findings, basically. Now let's talk about recovery from BPD, because this is a key concept. Recovery is defined as having a concurrent, at the same time, remission from BPD and narrowly defined good psychosocial functioning. So it's basically what most of us hope for ourselves and our children, that they don't have many psychiatric symptoms and that they have a rich life involving relationships and the ability to function in the world of work or school. Now, at the end of 10 years, 50% of borderline patients have attained this, which is very different than the 93% who had at least a two-year remission and the 86% who had at least a four-year remission. In terms of losing this outcome, which is certainly possible, there are two figures here. But let me first go on to the loss of recovery from BPD. The loss over after the percent would be 34%, so very close to the same percent who would lose a remission after 2 years. So just to recap, in terms of these major outcomes, 93% of borderline patients have at least a two-year remission, 86% have at least a four-year remission, and 50%, a disappointing 50%, have recovery from BPD. And in terms of the loss of these things, 30% have a recurrence of BPD after a two-year remission, 15% have a loss of a sustained remission, and 34% have a loss of recovery. Now, these are not bad numbers in terms of stability, but they could be better. Now, let's talk about predictors of time to remission from borderline personality disorder. What predicts it at 10-year follow-up or over 10 years of follow-up? There's seven factors were found to predict earlier time to remission, and this and many, in fact, all the other material I'm presenting, there are papers that you can get if you'd like in a PDF from me if you just email me at zanarini@mclean.harvard.edu. And these factors were younger age, being under the age of 26, having a good pre-morbid or before entering the hospital vocational record, no history of childhood sexual abuse, no family history of substance abuse, absence of an anxious cluster personality disorder, and that's avoidant and dependent personality disorder, having high agreeableness, which is part of normal personality, agreeableness, not having high agreeableness, and low neuroticism. And agreeableness is a measure of compassion, and neuroticism is a measure of symptoms, being anxious, being angry, being empty, that kind of stuff. Now, the nature of these predictors, four factors of these seven are commonly assessed in clinical practice. Younger age, we always assess demographics when we meet a patient for the first time. Good vocational record, we always assess psychosocial functioning before we begin working with someone. No history of childhood sexual abuse. We always assess adverse childhood events or experiences. And no family history of substance abuse. We always assess family history of psychiatric disorder. But the other three are often noticed but rarely discussed because they're areas of temperament. Again, it's absence of an anxious cluster PD, so you would be low in avoidance and low in dependence. High agreeableness, again, that's your level of compassion, so you're not particularly argumentative or manipulative. And low neuroticism, you don't typically feel inferior or ashamed, at least relatively so compared to other people with BPD. And the idea here is that temperament is a very important factor in terms of getting well. And in fact, I've done a study using 16-year data that looks at recovery, and temperament is even more important on for recovery than it is for remission. Let's talk about the psychiatric treatment in the MSAD sample. Mostly they're treated in the community. They get psychotherapy from psychologists or social workers, and they get their medications either from psychiatrists or more and more from their PCPs as long as their meds are stable. Many internists and family doctors feel comfortable practicing behavioral medicine. However, over 70% of patients with BPD are in individual therapy and taking standing medications during all five follow-up periods. So these are not intensive treatments. It's maybe once a week, once a month, something like that, but they stay in touch. And a lot of these therapies are very long-term. However, the rate of psychiatric hospitalization declined from the obvious 100% at baseline to 29% at 10-year follow-up. So the most expensive form of treatment really declines to only about a quarter of the people are using it. Now, I have a figure here showing polypharmacy at 10-year follow-up, and you might say, well, what's polypharmacy? Polypharmacy is using multiple medications at the same time to treat people. So you might be on an antidepressant, an anti-anxiety agent, a mood stabilizer at the same time. And for borderline patients, almost 40% take three or more medications at the same time. Over 20% take four or more, and over 10% take five or more. And you might say, well, if it's useful and helpful, isn't that okay? Well, it is okay if it's useful or helpful. But the problem is there's absolutely no empirical evidence for its efficacy or effectiveness. In fact, our group did the only study comparing monotherapy, one medication, to polypharmacy, two medications, and there was absolutely no difference. This is also a very costly form of treatment. It's also associated with very high rates of obesity. About a third of our subjects are now obese or were obese at 10-year follow-up. And almost all of these people were normal weight at baseline. Obesity, in turn, is associated with elevated rates. Remember, these people, on average, are only in their mid-30s now, with elevated rates of osteoarthritis, diabetes, hypertension, chronic back pain, urinary incontinence, GERD, and gallstones. So the health of the people who are obese really looks more like people who are substantially older. Now, let me review the main findings, and then I'll be glad to answer your questions. 93% of patients with BPD in a 10-year course experience a remission of their BPD. Their symptoms go way down. Recurrences of BPD are relatively rare. These remissions are stable. And as I mentioned before, the course of BPD is very different than that of mood disorders, where remission occurs much more rapidly, but recurrences are far more common. Completed suicide is substantially less common than the expected 10%. And this may, as we talked about before, be due to more trauma-sensitive or supportive treatments. BPD seems to be comprised of two types of symptoms, acute symptoms and temperamental symptoms, symptoms that are dramatic but resolve relatively rapidly, and temperamental symptoms that are quieter and take longer to resolve. And all of our major forms of treatment are aimed at the acute symptoms, which I think is interesting and unfortunate, but it also makes sense because that's what gets people into the hospital, and that's what's a public health problem. And almost 80% of patients with BPD attain broadly defined good psychosocial functioning, but only 64% attain narrowly defined good psychosocial functioning, and social functioning is less impaired than vocational functioning. Recovery from BPD is more difficult to attain than remission from BPD alone, and again, recovery is good social and vocational functioning as well as remission from BPD. However, once attained, it is relatively stable, and prediction to time of remission is multifactorial in nature. It's not all about childhood adversity. It involves factors that are routinely assessed in treatment and other factors, particularly aspects of temperament, that are not and that people feel awkward about addressing. Temperament can't be changed, but it can be, one can help people to move around it and still attain their goals. So in conclusion, the results of this study taken together suggest that the prognosis for most, but not all, patients with BPD is better than previously recognized. There are areas of real achievement, particularly symptomatic remission, and there are areas that are more regarded, particularly vocational functioning and its effect on a full recovery from BPD. Again, a low rate of suicide is also really good news. So right now, thank you very much for listening, and I'm open to answer your questions.
Thank you, Mary, so much. There is a question about empirical supported therapies. And the question is where does the Nancy Bloom Steeps, the group psychosocial intervention, fit?
Nancy Bloom and Don Black developed the STEPS program, which is an adjunctive treatment for BPD. It's a group formatted treatment where people attend for 20 weeks, and they can bring family members, their therapists, and others who are in their social support network.
Where? Let's see.
And it basically
Okay. Can
be added, is added, to whatever the person is already in, which can be individual therapy, meds, or both. And it has quite a good outcome, except it was not as successful as the comprehensive treatment in the area of treating self-harm and suicidality, but that could be because it's so much briefer. It is a group intervention, and to provide it does not require the same degree of expertise as these other treatments because the training is only for 2 days. But it is a good form of treatment, and it is something that many facilities can afford to provide.
Yeah, I believe that Holland has adopted it as a nationwide intervention for borderline personality disorder.
That's true. It's extremely popular there.
The other question that stems out of this is, what do we mean when we say empirically based? And, of course, you said comprehensive, and Nancy Bloom's intervention would probably not qualify as comprehensive. But when we say empirically based or supported, how do external bodies of independent people, what would they say about our treatments in borderline?
What would they say in terms of how good are they?
Yeah, like the Cochrane reviews, the people who do independent meta-analyses to assess the evidence for treatments and other things.
I'm just going to have to give you my opinion on that, but basically I'd say they had a moderate effect size, that they moved people forward. All of them moved people forward, by the way, at about the same degree. And they also have many elements in common. I think the good news is that because there's now a menu of five of these treatments, therapists can pick the one they're most comfortable with and be trained in that. And patients who are looking for various things, different approaches, can also find somebody, hopefully, who has that approach that they're comfortable with. No one of these treatments is markedly better than the other. They're better for certain patients and they're better for certain therapists, but there's no DBT has a greater evidence base, but I don't think there's evidence to suggest that it's necessarily better than the others. And the other one that's achieved probably the greatest interest in the U.S. is mentalization-based treatment because of the aggressive efforts of its developers to teach and train throughout the country and, in fact, the world on this method of therapy, which is based far more on a psychodynamic model of paying attention to people's attachments.
Okay, then the next question, there's a series of questions that came up on treatment. What kinds of therapy would be appropriate for the temperamental symptoms, or would be promising at least, in your view?
Well, if that such a treatment were to be developed, I think you'd have to work on helping people to identify that these are symptoms that are problematic and working with them to develop strategies to get around them. If you're a very dependent person, how do you get around that? If you tend to avoid anxiety, how do you get around that? It sounds like it would be part of standard cognitive behavioral therapy, but because there isn't really one like that for BPD, it would need to be developed as a full-on push to get people to see that these are problematic parts of their temperament, but that they can be worked around so you can achieve your goals, and also to help people come up with goals so it's worth their time and effort to struggle against these temperamental symptoms.
Okay. With the, depression. With the close link and persistence of depression, is there an order relationship? Should one treat borderline before the depression, or depression before the borderline, or do they need to be treated concurrently? And what's most successful with depression?
That's a very good question, because depression is such a common co-occurring disorder with BPD, and it's controversial. I think practically speaking, most patients are treated who have recognized BPD, and that's, a lot of people are not told they have BPD. But if they have been told, I think they tend to have their BPD and their depression treated at the same time, their BPD through psychotherapy, their depression through medications. But some people, particularly John Gunderson, does not believe that borderline patients have the same type of depression as other people. because I have many of the physical symptoms of depression. I don't agree in that I think it's more than that. I think some borderline patients have very typical depressions that you would see in other people. Some have this more atypical form. It's almost a form of demoralization where people feel down, but they don't have all the trouble sleeping, eating, and so on of other patients. And I think realizing their subtypes could help guide treatment and figuring which your patient is in. But if you have both, you probably should be treated for both at the same time. Jim, are there other questions?
Mary, we might have lost Jim.
Jim, no, I'm
here.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah, we're just getting worse weather, I think. Does your study, the McLean study, or the collaborative, or other research have anything to say about the role of the family in aiding the movement to remission and then recovery?
First, I'd like to say that I think an awful lot of families have been unfairly blamed for their child's BPD. I think what most people think now, who are thought leaders in this area, is that BPD really comes from a particularly sensitive, vulnerable nature. There are some people who have catastrophic forms of abuse or neglect, but most people with BPD do not. They have average expectable parents who do average expectable things that work with their other children and don't work with this child because the child is different, more vulnerable. And this suggests there's a whole movement to down-age BPD and diagnose it in adolescence and possibly even in children younger than that. With Marianne Goodman, I'm conducting a study of 13 to 17-year-olds with BPD, and they're symptomatically absolutely identical. They don't have emerging BPD. They have full-blown BPD, even as young teenagers. And if parents only knew what their child was suffering from, they could be taught about the disorder and really be enormously helpful rather than being stigmatized as the cause of the disorder. They live with the child 24 hours a day, and they could be well aware from an early age that this is a youngster who's going to need more support, more help developing a cognitive map of what's going on, more practice that, no, you didn't get invited to that dance, but that's not a reason to tear your room apart and cut yourself and scream at me for 3 hours and slam the door in my face 8 times. That basically, let's plan for the fact that you might not get invited, but we can all go out someplace discreet where nobody will know that you didn't get invited and still have a good time going to a movie that night or something like that. This is an ongoing thing where you have to using your anticipatory skills to help the person to ward off an emotional storm that only leaves them shaken and ashamed, which is a terrible state to be in.
Do you think DSM-5 will remove the age 21, below 21 exclusion of borderline?
I've heard various people on the committee say that it will. But the whole process of coming up with criteria for BPD and DSM-5 has been so problematic that I'm not sure what the criteria are, let alone what the age that will be applied to them. It's been a difficult process, and I think it's still a matter that's in flux.
And we've talked about depression and its close relationship with BPD, and then there's the confusion where often bipolar is diagnosed instead of borderline.
Correct.
And, of course, people get very different and inappropriate treatment. But isn't there a relationship in fact between borderline and bipolar?
In my study in unpublished 16-year results, about 20% of borderline patients actually go on to develop some form of bipolarity. But that's not the 100% that a Kiskel, for example, a thought leader in this area, said would actually occur. Borderline patients are very emotionally labile or dysregulated, but they swing through multiple moods per day, none of them happy. People with bipolar 2 disorder experience sustained periods of feeling up, good, superior, grandiose at last that are a somewhat milder form of what you experience in bipolar 1, which is full-blown mania where the person may actually reach a grandiosity to the point of psychosis. But borderline patients have no sustained periods of good moods, and the treatment is very different. Somebody with bipolar disorder, you would tend to give them a mood stabilizer and possibly an antipsychotic, and psychotherapy would not really be part of the package, just efforts to make them or encourage people to take their medications. And why this mistake keeps occurring over and over, I think a lot of it is that people just think treaters don't know that BPD is a good symptomatic outcome, so they prefer to give them something they think has a better outcome, which is simply not true. Bipolar disorder does not have a great prognosis symptomatically, although people may be able to function somewhat better with it or maybe not. So it's a matter of either a lack of familiarity with the true prognosis of BPD symptomatically or more comfort with medication, but it's a bad and serious mistake and one that really needs to be, I would say 95% of the people in my study have been told that they're bipolar at one point or another, and they often believe it to the point where we can't, shake them out of their answers, although they seem stilted, and really to be memorized from somebody else's words, not really from their own inner experience. So maybe that 20% is actually lower, and some of that is more them reporting what someone's told them than what they've actually experienced.
Okay. Is achieving vocational success or sustainability a contributing factor in the progression to remission from the symptoms of BPD, or is it something that has to wait for a substantial remission for a vocational success to occur?
I don't think you have to. It depends on who you are. There's a subgroup of people who are hospitalized at McLean who left the hospital and pretty much, particularly if they were students, they were able to return to school and hang on and graduate. Then there are other people for whom remission, not only of their BPD, but their co-occurring disorders might need to occur before they get a job. But the most important thing is family and friends and treaters really seeing this as important and really emphasizing it and really pushing for the person to function in this realm, because I always think work is just day treatment for the rest of us. And it's good for everybody. It helps to organize you. It allows you the independence of an income. And there are some people who are so impaired that they won't work, but those really are a small minority.
Okay, there's, you triggered a lot of questions, but we are out of time, and we don't want to overstay our position on you. We really appreciate, Mary, you're making yourself available for this very informative session that has engaged a flood of questions here and interest, and is help bring people up to date on the latest findings from your research. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And remember, next Sunday, 8 o'clock, same time, Ed Shelby will be here with his emotional cascade approach on treatment, which I think will trigger a lot of interest about treatment methods. Everybody, have a good evening. Stay dry and stay safe if you're in the path of the Frankenstorm. And we'll see you next Sunday. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.